This is the first day of this 4-day Sesshin. And being the first day, I will talk a bit about foundation and preparing the ground in the practice of experience of illumination and investigation. And this is what Zazen or Zen practice is. When we do practice, when we practice Zen or any other form of spiritual or Buddhist practice, we need to take refuge. We need to put our mind into trust, a place of trust. We could say in a way that this is the faith mind or heart mind trusting itself, looking in or turning to the heart mind with the heart mind. We chant every morning the what we call tillit till sinnet in Swedish, but in English the Rochester version that we used before, it's called affirming faith in mind. But recently I heard that before they called it verses of the faith mind. And this is really very much to the point. The faith mind is what we use and what we put our mind into. So this is what practice is about. So we have to put our refuge into this. It's like an anchor, an asylum, a home, a haven. We could say that it's a place of immunity, a port. This is also a recourse where you can, a source of help in difficult situations, a retreat, a sanctuary. Can say it's also a keep. This word keep in English is a good one. It means many things. It can be a noun, it can be a verb. And as a verb, it means to abide by or be devoted to, faithful, be loyal, be true, to follow or fulfill, maintain, observe, practice, respect, stand by, support, and carry. This is what you find if you look it up in a dictionary. It's a very rich word. The word keep as a noun means a tower of a fortress, the head tower, something that was used a long time ago, many hundreds of years ago. I don't know if it's used so much anymore. And when I looked it up, it said that this was used as a refuge or a last resort should the rest of the castle fall to an adversary, be taken in by an enemy, let's say. Could also be associated with a tower in a castle that could serve both as a fortified, high-status private residence for, I guess, a king or something like that. And at the same time, a refuge and last resort. And, of course, this, seeing it as a tower, this also points out the fact that this place of practice is a place where you have, where you can really see things. You have a good outlook, we could say. will get back to that later. But anyway, to be able to both start and to then continue one's Zen practice, one somehow has to take refuge. This involves faith, of course, and trust. Without this, it cannot be done. Especially not if we want to stay with practice for an extended period. This is for life, basically. And this trust, we can say, happens when conditions are ripe or right, fall into place. It cannot really be forced or controlled. This, in a way, we can say it's when we are prepared to give in to practice or give up what we need to give up to take refuge in practice. And this is why we cannot talk anyone into practice, tell them how great it is and how good it is for everyone. This is not what we do. There's no point to be a Zen missionary. Some people try that maybe, especially when one is starting and feel great about it, and it might be feel like a great change to one, for oneself and one's life. One feel enthusiastic. Also maybe wanting to explain or tell people how great this is. They might be a bit suspicious or question why you do it, especially if you do something like training in a full-time place like Sangodan, or if you go to long retreats or sesshins. People might question that. Why do you put so much time into this? What's the point? But to convince someone of the greatness of Zazen is usually not very helpful. What one can do is to share somewhat one's experience. Be honest but quite simple about it. Otherwise one can get quite entangled. That's my experience. So don't start to talk about emptiness and stuff like that. You might end up regretting it. When the trust deepens, the outward changing, constantly changing conditions that we always meet in our lives won't make one turn away from practice. One won't be dependent on certain conditions anymore. And if there's doubt in the mind, this doubt is a more fundamental kind of doubt that will keep us going in practice rather than the opposite. It's not the doubt, should I sit this morning, should I do this, should I continue, that can of course come up also. But underneath, if there's doubt when we're more connected to practice, the doubt will be motivating doubt. I remember someone saying something like this, and actually this is quite common. The person said, I feel stuck with my Zazen practice now. And I do feel stuck in another way also, because I don't really see anything happening. Or at least I can't say what is happening when I practice. And if I'm honest, I don't really know what to do or why I'm doing it. But at the same time, I'm convinced that this is the right thing to do. Especially when I'm sitting there and doing my zazen. Then it's very clear to me that this is a very important thing in my life. It's probably the most important thing in my life. So now I have noticed, a little bit to my own surprise, that I do not get discouraged anymore. I just accept things the way they are. And we should not mistake this kind of not knowing and a little bit not knowing where to go or why, not being able to explain it with discouragement or lack of motivation. This saying things about how serious people are or motivated, this is something one should be careful about. It easily slips out. People say things like that. Maybe if you're a Sandra leader, you say, oh, so-and-so person is really putting it in there and is so serious and sincere. Or, I don't know about such and such a person. It's really hard to determine things like that. Or it's even pointless. Of course, it's important for, let's say, the teacher, if people apply to a Sushin or apply to come and train here at Sangorden, to determine if that's something good for that person or not. Or if the person fits in, meaning that it works for a person, him or herself and others. But otherwise, it's something we should be careful about. When it comes to our own practice, of course, but also others. And this can go both ways. It can go in the way that we criticize or have ideas about people not being serious or not doing good practice, but it can also be the opposite. Having ideas that people are so great and enlightened and blah, blah, blah. You could say that to take refuge is simply to keep to it. This word keep again. To keep it, to keep the practice. You can even say, take away the to. You can say, keep the breath. Keep the zazen itself. And of course, this refuge is not seeking out some hiding place for oneself, where one can kind of be away from difficulty and complicated situations. Rather, it's the intention to take a firm stand in the midst of whatever is going on, to commit to it, the process itself. Of course, sometimes I wonder when this kind of talk about escaping or hiding away, I wonder to myself, how is that even possible? To hide from difficulty and complications. I mean, we might try, but sooner or later it doesn't work, of course. I mean, even sitting by oneself in a hut somewhere, we know this, if we have the experience of doing that, that doesn't mean that we are hiding away from difficulty and complications, because we are faced with whatever it is there in our minds. As they say in Star Trek, resistance is futile, you will be assimilated. And with practice, it's definitely possible to pass through difficulty and complications. So the refuge, taking refuge, is to take a firm stand, and as I said, to have the intention to do so. It can even start when we decide to commit to practice, can start with on an intellectual level even. We might read, we might hear something. Or we might feel deep need for change in our lives. Maybe that we don't know how and what we want to change, but we know we want to change something. And then we turn to find a place. Well, place, it's not really a place in a real sense, but a space in the mind and also in the environment, we could say, where we can actually rest. A place from where we can have a good view. That keep again, and then feel that we have enough support. And there are lookouts and upkeepers of this tower or castle of ours, or our refuge, place of refuge, which are one's own physical and mental and spiritual capabilities, as well as the support from various other things and people, including our fellow practitioners, teachers, and ancestors, being present or not present in one's life, being alive or not. There are many supporters of practice. This is also something we need to trust, that there will always be support for practice if we put our mind into it. So we're not hiding, even though it can be necessary to actually hide in the sense that we need to find a space out of sight, so to speak. I remember I was in my early 7 day sessions, early in my practice, and I was trying to really keep to my question. And sometimes I found it hard, and I tried to find ways to put my mind into it without getting disturbed. Remember going into the cushion storage room and sitting there in a corner, or was it what's called the basement zendo in Rochester Zen Center, where with chairs where you could sit informally. And I sat there in a corner, and at that point in my practice it was helpful to do that. That's not hiding in the real sense, hiding away from anything, but you could say to get the sanctuary, a place where you can actually let go and not get distracted. You need to feel protected somehow and safe. And also find a place where we have a good lookout, where we can look in and we can look out, so to speak. The enemy, this is this word enemy comes from the old French enemy, and it means and also Latin inimicus or something like that. An in is not, an amicus is friend, so it's not friend. And there are many enemies, we could say, at least this is the way we see it. or sense it, many faces that might disturb us. Skeptical faces, fearful faces, maybe hateful, greedy, jealous faces, exhausted faces, weak, restless faces, confused faces. But they only become enemies, non-friends, when you see them as real, really existing. When you imagine that they will somehow be able to threaten you in a real sense, because this is of course not true. A mask or a role or something that comes up in the mind, it can of course not really threat you. But with practice we become more well prepared for this. And then we are not taken by surprise anymore when these faces appear. And then even if we cannot really control them, because they do come and go as they want, it seems, we can still keep our stand. It won't be too much for us. So what is this, to be well prepared? Well, in one sense, we could say that we do build up by preparing ourselves. We build up strength in practice with time and effort. Of course, this is true, but in another sense, it's pretty much only about being alert and aware in each moment with one's practice. Putting the attention to that, what one has set out to do. Being present in each moment will build this strength. And with this stronger focus and absorption, greater clarity will come. And then, more and more so, it's possible to accept the process of life and practice without guarantees. There's no hesitation anymore, because the hesitation comes from the not knowing if where it will lead us. But when we have enough strength, we will be able to let go, even though we don't know. We are able to take risks. And of course, the main risk here is to lose ourselves. And we're not embarking on this journey because it always feels great, or because we can be sure to get to this or that place, or get this and that result. Now, at some point we will do it because it is what we do, what we have to do, what, no matter what. For me personally, it was not the question of knowing what practice would bring when I started, or where it would take me. I'm a so-called Zen teacher today, but of course that was not, absolutely not in my mind. I don't think it was in my mind even when I was asked by my teacher to start teach. Not even shortly before that. But definitely not in the beginning. I was nothing like that. I didn't know at all what would happen. Of course, as anyone who starts practice and are prepared to put that kind of time and effort into it, I did, of course, hope for some kind of liberation from pain and uncertainty. I think that was a very motivating factor for me, the hope for some kind of liberation from emotional pain, sense of insecurity, low self-esteem, depression, and so forth. But there was something beyond that, something that made me feel that I could not do it. And this feeling also came with a very strong force quite early in practice, which is, I don't think, always the case. In this way, I was lucky. Because this sense, when we have this sense of having no choice, of course, it simplifies things for us. If we think we have a choice, we start to think about, should I do this? Should I do that? And I didn't either think of doing some other kind of practice. I didn't know, basically, of any other kind of practice, and I didn't think of it. I thought this was it. This doesn't mean that this is the right thing for everyone, or that I could not have benefit from something else, but this was it for me at that point. And afterwards, I feel lucky that that was the case. It made it quite simple and liberating to just go with that kind of sense of force, not analyzing it so much. And this sense of having no choice might sound extreme if you talk about it to people, or kind of romantic or exaggerated. And I did, as I talked about before, I was saying things like that to my friends and family, which in some ways freaked them out a bit. I remember my mother thought I was really now into a cult, even though she was very careful about saying anything like that. I think now, this was 30 years ago, I think now people are at least less suspicious of meditation or spiritual practice. There are so many people now doing yoga and meditation. So even though there are many, maybe, strands and ways of doing yoga and meditation that might not go as deep as some other parts of it, I think it's quite good that you can at least just say, I'm a meditation teacher. And then someone might say, oh, it's like, oh, I know, I do yoga, or my friend do yoga or meditation. And you just say, yeah, that's it. And you don't have to say much more. We might find practice difficult at times very difficult even, in different ways, but still we do return to our sasan. And the pain of this practice, physical or mental or both, will come. It's inevitable for everyone if you do serious practice. Now that came, the serious practice. But can use it if we're not talking about a certain person. And we do not stop because of this, because of these difficulties. For example, most people who come to Sushin or longer retreats and sit a lot are challenged by that, but they still will come back again. Because this mental and physical challenge is also what makes it worth it. This is what makes us go deeper, stay with it, take refuge, this repeated returning to the cushion and the mat is in itself the practice, and to take refuge in the practice, to keep it, to keep the process itself going, in pain as well as joy. Like a stream moving through a landscape, the landscape is changing, but the stream just continues, not knowing what is going to come, because the force of the stream doesn't have a choice. At some point in my own practice, I was able to let go of everything but the process itself, being with practice moment by moment. And I remember when that started to happen, how safe and deeply relaxed I felt for the first time. I finally started to feel, maybe we could say, at home in my own heart-mind. This is so strange that we do not feel at home in our own heart-mind. That it takes quite a lot of work, we can say, or at least attention to feel at home in our own heart-mind, even though we're there all the time. And then, this is what is called effortless effort, maybe. And the only thing then, after coming to that place or point in practice, then one can go along with it. The refuge is there naturally. Whatever happens, this is a marvelous feeling. This marvelous feeling is becoming aware of the real Buddha seed potential, sensing its presence, knowing that it's true, this Buddha seed potential. It's not just something we heard or maybe slightly believe in, but it's something we know, even before it's really bloom. It's here right now, in this moment, fully present and alive. This insight is, we could say, a mixture of complete naturalness. I don't even know if that's a word, but naturalness and mystery at the same time. Then we can say with conviction, I take refuge in Buddha and resolve that with all beings I will understand the great way whereby the Buddha seed may forever thrive, as we say in the Three Refuges. But we can't just focus on that seed. This would be like looking from the outside, we could say, or just thinking about Zen or Zazen, not practicing it, because practicing it is to cultivate the ground where the seed can grow. Attending to this groundwork, then the seed will by itself thrive, sprout and grow and bear fruit. But if we stay with that sense of awe, there is something called awakening, it's a possibility, but we do not practice. It's like leaving the ground unattended. The seed, even if it's a marvelous seed with great potential, will just stay a seed. Like a thought of something wonderful, or a memory, a dream of some plant, but not a living reality. It's like when you find this, I found an old bag of seeds for flowers, and there is a picture on the bag of beautiful, bright flowers. But those flowers are only a picture. And of course, I need to put some effort into getting those seeds to grow. And that's completely inevitable to me. This is the same with practice, of course. And the interesting thing also with talking about this bag of seeds is that we firmly trust and believe that those seeds actually can become flowers, even though when we look at them, they're just little brown, tiny, dry things. We do firmly believe that they will become flowers. If you show them to someone, anyone, maybe not a child or someone who doesn't know about those things, but most people, if you show this bag and you say, "Do you really believe that these seeds can become flowers?" People will say, "Of course. Of course. That's how it is. Of course, that's the way things are." That's trust. And of course, that trust comes from experience. And belief also. So the attending to is actually doing it. The doing it is it. And of course, in the deepest sense, there is nothing to prepare. It's just practice. But at the same time, including in the practice, or practice is preparation of the soil, digging and planting, watering. If we think about that, we sit there with the seed and we think about all the work, then there can be strong resistance to do this groundwork. We might hope that we could skip all that effort and just jump straight into clarity and peace and joy. It's not as easy as going to buy a flower that is already a flower instead of planting a seed. It doesn't work that way, of course. And also, why would we want that? The process is it. It's not just the seed, and then bang, a flower. The process is it. And then it goes on, of course, we know this. The flower will wilt and die, but it will leave seeds. It can be planted and then sprout and grow and so forth. This is how it works. Never ending. Prepare is to care, and that care is everything in practice. And anything precious to us, we will attend to carefully, with great focus. If someone will say to you, "Look at that door. This door goes to a place of complete satisfaction and peace." But first you have to care for the door to be able to open it and use it. You have to oil its hinges and handle. You have to care for it with great attention. Wow. Finding a door leading to true peace. Of course we would do whatever it would take if we believed in that. We'll do anything to care for that door and protect it and make it work. And it's the same thing with this so-called Buddha seed. The Buddha seed, it is the natural light of mind, the clarity that is the natural state of everything. But to realize it, its full potential, we have to attend to the sometimes very challenging process of preparing, clearing, cultivating, and so forth. That's it. So sitting down to do zazen is to take out the seeds from the bag and then take care of them. And we know that the weather is unpredictable. This is like future circumstances are unknown. So we cannot just be dependent on that. We just have to attend to it. The breath, the body, the sitting, the inquiry, whatever. It's like the training here at Sandgården. We don't know what will happen. Will there be people here? Will people come and train? Will people come to Sushin? What will happen in the future? And because of the fact that I talked about before, that you can't really sail it. You can't go out and make big commercials and say, come, train, come to Sushin, it's the greatest thing. People have to come by themselves when time is ripe. And then you just have to follow along with whatever happens. Might be one person, two people, no people. Well, there will always be someone. We never know. So we attempt to practice not knowing. We trust. We take refuge. This is the end of the teacher today, and we will now make three prostrations.